Hey, how's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Welcome to it. I am writing an email on my radio show. I'm trying to get Jim Loeb on. Wouldn't that be cool? I haven't talked to Jim in a while. 2:30 Eastern. Neocon history, not the current Iraq debate. Thanks, best Scott. All right. Now, so the thing of it is that Jim Loeb is the world's greatest expert on the neocons, and there's this article by some lady, I forget her name, who wrote this thing. And it's about the neocons and who they are and what they're about. And it's hardly comprehensive, but it brings up a very important idea. Oh, here it is. It's Diana West. Oh, here he is calling me back. Here, let me play a soundbite for you real quick. Oh, I don't even have my dang soundbite player open. All right, hang on, everybody. 1 second. I'll be right back after this. Part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audio book of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, well, screw that up, man. What a rough start to the show. All that typing out loud, writing an email out loud, and then the phone ringing, and then I hope you enjoyed that commercial. No, Jim. Can't get Jim. He's busy. He would love to, I think. He actually didn't say that, but I'm pretty sure he meant to say, I would love to, but I just can't do it today. Not at those times. All right. Well, anyway. I don't know. Maybe some people don't know all this stuff, and maybe they want to know. I was very happy to learn about the neocons when I learned about the neocons. And Jim Loeb is really good on them. He's been watching them since the late 60s, since the dawn of their movement, since they quit being Reds and became a bunch of brown shirt fascists instead. It was the move. That's why they're neo-conservatives, because they used to be commies. Or at least, well, in the second and third generation, I guess, a lot of them were just kind of Truman Democrat, Cold War liberal types. Just still red to me, but I guess not really. But anyway, none of them are, you know, born and raised conservatives. They're former leftists who became right-wingers. I guess one exception to that would be Bill Kristol, whose father was a communist and then became a right-winger. And then Bill Kristol was, I guess, you know, raised after the conversion there. But he's still completely neo-con on every single question. He might as well have used to have been a Trotskyite. And I know that people talk about the Straussians, but the Straussians, of course, they were taught by Strauss, who was a former Trotskyite, who moved to the right. And then his buddy also at the University of Chicago, Leon Wallstetter, who was Paul Wolfowitz's mentor. Former Trotskyite. So none of these guys are very far removed from the founder of the Soviet Union's Red Army, Lenin's sidekick, Leon Trotsky. And what's fun about it, see, is how when liberals, I'll just tell you what Jim Loeb would have told you only quicker. When liberals became hippies and peaceniks during Vietnam, these guys moved to the right because they had an overriding commitment to Israel first. And America had to remain a militarist imperial power no matter what so that it could always protect Israel. And if a bunch of, you know, liberal, hippie, isolationist dove types were able to win the day and bring America home, then who's going to protect their Israel? And so that's really what they're all about. And that's why they moved to the right more than anything else. And And then, you know, through the 70s, they challenged the detente policy and the Nixonian, you know, cooling off. Detente means the cooling off, the peaceful coexistence type policy with the Soviet Union instead of brinksmanship and Cold War. And they fought against that, and they subverted it, and they exploited it to get to, well, basically they tied the grain shipments to Jewish emigration from Russia, which possibly, I haven't really nailed this down, possibly is part of the reason why I have my wife, is because of these neocons twisting the arms of Nixon to twist the arms of the Russians to let more Jews leave the Soviet Union. My wife is from Ukraine. They were allowed to leave in 1978, I think it was, 77, 78, anyway. So that's part of the neocon project, those bastards, but thanks. And but then in 1980, they all sided with the Reaganites. And they got jobs, many of them, got jobs as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for choosing who to kill. And mostly the Reaganites kept them out of the Middle East and let them focus on macheting little children to death down in El Salvador and stuff like that. And then in the 90s, they were kind of out of power. John Judas wrote in Foreign Affairs, "From Trotskyism to anachronism, we're done with the neocons. Their bankrupt, ridiculous Cold War ideology is now..." This was in 1995, is now 6-7 years out of date, and it's time for them to go get real jobs and yada yada, But then, oh, and I left out their ties to Lockheed. The military-industrial complex, basically, they didn't have their own think tanks. They needed brainiacs to come up with policy papers to justify their expenditures. The bankers and the oil men had the Council on Foreign Relations going back 100 years. But they kind of, the military-industrial complex, post-World War II wealth, they could contribute, but it'd be better, they figured, to have their own think tanks. And so they made their alliance with the neocons and the Israelis to create. I mean, really, most of these think tanks exist in one office building in Bill Kristol's desk drawer. But they created a million of them. I guess that's oversimplifying a bit, but they created a million of them. For example, and this is not all-encompassing, but you have the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, the American Enterprise Institute. I don't guess, I think Heritage was originally created by actual conservatives, but then was taken over by the neocons. You got the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, Foundation for Defense of Democracies, the Center for Security Policy, the Project for a New American Century, the Emergency Committee for Israel, and then the Sabin Center is how they took over the Brookings Institution, which was basically like a more of a center-left Democrat, Bill Clinton-type thing. And then... who am I leaving out? But anyway, they're all just a bunch of Bill Kristol echo chamber nonsense. And you got, really, we're talking about the neoconservative movement is a total of, I don't know, less than 100 people, 75 guys, maybe something like that. And so some of them working in state and defense and for certain congressmen, many of them write at magazines and on major newspaper editorial boards, like especially the Washington Post. And still, despite how kind of individually discredited they are, their narrative rules the day because it's just what the state wants to hear. Deficits don't matter. The amount of power that you guys can exercise can never be too much. Go ahead and go for it. You know, for right-wingers, their position on markets, as William Kristol's father Irving put it, is two cheers for capitalism. So go ahead and regulate. Go ahead and subsidize. Go ahead and control. And so here now is this article by Diana West in, I guess, McClatchy newspapers, saying neocons are going home to the left. And she's talking about, remember that article I mentioned to you about Robert Kagan in the New York Times about how he's voting Hillary Clinton. And he says, "Don't call me a neocon. I always was just a liberal interventionist." That's the guy that wrote Toward a Neo-Reaganite Foreign Policy with Bill Kristol back in 96. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. All right. So yesterday, during the interview part of the show, I just blew every single freaking break, and I'm sorry. I'm sure it sounded terrible for those of you who are listening live to just have it interrupted by the music and the commercials and all that, but I just... Anyway. And also, I did a terrible job of interviewing that lady. I feel like an idiot about it because I really should have thought to reread the article. I had 9 minutes at the top of the hour break where I could have blasted through and reread her article and taken a bunch of notes, but I was too stupid to think to do that. So then I went in the damn article kind of unprepared, going off the top of my head. And bam. It was a good article, though. You should read it. The interview wasn't even really worth listening to, but the article is great. And that's my fault, not hers. But the article is great. The article is, again, The Jihadist Next Door. No, wait. The Jihad Next Door. I misread it the first time as jihadist, but that ain't right. The Jihad Next Door in Politico Magazine. Long-form journalism about the history of the Syrian war. And there's not a lot of talk about American support and American weapons ending up in the hands of the rebels and whatever. Although, I think that is in there briefly, and she certainly doesn't deny it. It's just not what the story's about. She's not trying to make the scandal out of U.S. support, and she says, you know, any reluctance to give more weapons to the Syrian rebels then would certainly be justified, because the weapons do get around. But anyway, I got two interviews today, and I'll try to conduct them better than that. Actually, that's not true. I'm probably going to interview Mitchell Prothero straight through the break and try to make a good half hour of it and use that for the KPFK show on Sunday. He's got a lot to talk about. He's in Iraq reporting right now. And so, yeah. I guess we'll see how it goes. In just a few minutes, Kara Dansky from the ACLU will be on about that militarization of the police report, which I think is very important. All right, now, so I got interrupted at the break where I was talking about the neocons there, about how Robert Kagan is saying, hey, I was always a Democrat. In fact, Richard Perle is always a card-carrying Democrat, too. Just because he worked for Ronald Reagan didn't mean he was really had become a Republican. They're all just Truman Democrats, basically. And here, the co-author of Toward a Neo-Reaganite Foreign Policy, Bill Kristol's alter ego, Robert Kagan, who is just... written a book saying Obama doesn't kill people enough and America must embrace world empire forever and all this national greatness and the liberal world order. Yeah, America is what's keeping the world liberal right now, you see, he says. And even in the most barest, you know, sense of that term, in the old classical sense, not seeing much of America accomplishing spreading of liberalism around the world right now. But anyway, so he says, yeah, no, he's going to vote for Hillary Clinton. And he always was a liberal interventionist. And what's the difference anyway? Yeah, good point. And there's a lesson in there for right-wingers, of course, which is you guys have been the useful idiots of a bunch of damned Democrats this whole time. A bunch of former Trotskyites who became Democrats, who care more about a foreign country, Israel, than they care about the United States of America, and who have an ideology of big government in every way. They are centrist extremists in every way. They're for the welfare state. They're for the warfare state, first and foremost. They're for the regulatory state. And they're for the status quo. You could call them Bill Clintonites. You could call them Obama bots. You know, if they weren't attacking him for being such a coward, they'd be praising him for killing people all the time. In fact, William Crystal did praise Barack Obama and called him, you know, benevolent dear leader and all of this crap in the Weekly Standard for doubling down on the Afghan war. Right? Not for nothing, but for the Afghan war. And Dick Cheney for a long time has praised Obama too and has cited Obama as proof that what he did was right. Because if it wasn't right, then how come Obama's doing it too, he would say. Now, of course, in partisan politics, it always is easier to just pretend the Democrats are the sissies and the Republicans are the tough guys or whatever, even though that's completely stupid. You know, add up total body counts of Democrats since, I don't know, Jackson, and get back to me. How about since Wilson, the first real liberal? Because after all, Jackson was a right winger. How about the idealist Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt and Jack Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama? These guys with their mountains of skulls. I didn't leave out Truman that time, did I? The butcher of Asia. Anyway, so the neocons, they're the ones what got America into this mess. They're the ones who lied us into war quite deliberately. And I just read this article, and it's unfortunate because it has kind of too much liberal BS in it, but it is valuable. It's at Mother Jones, and it's about how right-wingers will believe what they are told. You know, they'll act like they're the authoritarian boss in charge, but they're not. They're the, you know, you might be the head of your family, conservatives out there, but boy, when it comes to believing what you're told by former communists who became Truman Democrats and still call themselves liberal interventionists who devise your entire worldview for you, boy, oh boy, conservatives in America, in their majority, still believe that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and had a role, not just was friends with Osama, but had a role in the 9/11 attacks. Oh yeah? Well, if Saddam didn't do 9/11, then how come I supported a war against him then? Because I'm an idiot? Yeah, right, I don't think so, they say. Cognitive dissonance problem solved. He's guilty of the 9/11 attack. In 2014, they still believe this. Oh my God. It's really incredible. But that's what happened, was a bunch of former communists and their students lied you into war with Iraq, because that's what Ariel Sharon wanted, because that's what they told him and told Netanyahu before him would be good for Israel, because they're stupid and because they believe the lies of Iranian spy Ahmed Chalabi and his Iraqi National Congress. They were bankrolled by the Iranians into lying to the neocons, into believing that a war against Iraq would be good for Israel. Now, you could say, okay, the largest and could be most powerful Arab nation state has been smashed. That's okay, but still, that's not what they were going for in the first place. Certainly not under the dominion of the Iranians, ruling all the land from Baghdad to Basra and increasing the power of Iran by a million times. They believed they would get a Hashemite king from the Hashemite tribe installed in power by the Brits back 100 years ago that still rule in Jordan, that they would have a Hashemite king, that they would build an oil and water pipeline to Haifa, which now they got an oil pipeline to Haifa, but it's coming from Kurdistan. I don't know how long that's going to last. And they were going to get, you know, either a Hashemite king or Ahmed Chalabi, and Iraq was going to be easy pickings and easy takings and easy occupyings, easier than the West Bank. And then they were going to put all the pressure on Iran after that, when in fact, nope, America was just doing Iran's dirty work this whole damn time. And now, I'm sorry, we got to take this break, because I wanted to point out real quick that Russia, Syria, Iraq, and Iran are right now fighting Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And whose side is America on? Okay, both. The Emergency Committee for Israel, Brookings, Heritage, AIPAC, WINEP, GINSA, PNAC, CNAS, the AEI, FPI, CFR, and CSP. It sure does seem sometimes like the war party's got the foreign policy debate in D.C. all locked up. But not quite. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They put America first, opposing our government's world empire, and especially their Middle Eastern madness. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about commodity discs from commoditydiscs.com. They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code commodity disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's commoditydiscs.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest on the show today is Kara Dansky from the ACLU. And she's helped with this new report, War Comes Home, the Excessive Militarization of American Policing. Welcome to the show, Kara. How are you doing?
Hi, good. Thanks for having me.
Good. Very happy to hear that, and very happy to have you here. Appreciate you joining us today. And appreciate this work. It's such important work. And like I always tell the people, and I learned this lesson, I guess, watching 2020 when I was a kid, that, wow, so if these lawyers don't show up at work at their nonprofit and sue the government all day, it doesn't get sued. If the ACLU does not demand accountability, there is no accountability in the American system. That's basically the way it is. And that's not just the ACLU. There are other groups like you, of course, that pursue the same sort of work. But, you know, this kind of thing is so important to, you know, preserving freedom in America, what we have left of it at this point anyway. And so thank you so much for doing it and helping draw attention to this. And I even think that maybe this is actually going to do some good, and that maybe this is really just a drop in that wave of real pushback against this as it becomes more of kind of common knowledge among everyone, not just sort of infringe political opinion, but among all American society, that this militarization of our local deputy sheriffs has just gotten completely out of control here. So enough of my rant and raving. That's just a big extended thank you is all, really. Before we get to the beginning about the military training and the turning of the cops into the soldiers, I was hoping that you could start with sort of the second section here, obviously ties into how the study was actually done, what information you were able to get, and what police agencies even had any information to give you, to what degree they were willing to cooperate, to let you know about what it was that they were up to, and all that kind of thing. If you could get that out of the way for us, please.
Absolutely. And, you know, I appreciate you having me on, and I appreciate your calling attention to this. And it's a really important point that you raise in terms of what is known and what is not known about this problem. You know, transparency is a real issue here, and data on the militarization of policing is very difficult to come by. We went directly to local law enforcement agencies. We didn't submit record requests to DOD or DHS or DOJ or any of the state agencies. We went directly to local law enforcement, and we asked them to give us records of all of their SWAT deployments for a two-year period of time. We were looking at 2011 and 2012. And we also asked them to send us records of equipment that they may have gotten from DOD during that time period, or money that they may have gotten from the Department of Justice or Homeland Security that they used to buy military equipment. So we asked for a lot of information, and to answer your question directly, they were all over the map in terms of how they responded. Some law enforcement agencies turned over a lot of information. Some gave us none. And other agencies were at different points along the spectrum. Part of what makes analysis of this issue so difficult is that law enforcement agencies really vary a lot in terms of how they keep records of their SWAT deployments. Some keep a lot of information. Some don't keep very much information at all. So we did our analysis based on the information that we had available. But one of our biggest concerns is that there's not a lot of information available, and we're really hoping that will change.
Yeah. All right. Now, another thing here is something that was highlighted by Radley Balco at the Washington Post about this Massachusetts, I don't know exactly what they call it, but some kind of multi-jurisdictional task force that they've put together here, that they refused to answer any kind of open records request on the grounds that they're a private company and not actually a public police agency at all. And I guess, first of all, did I even really say that right at all? But then secondly, what exactly does that mean? Is that just a trick of paperwork in order to avoid public records? Or is this actually a new creature, more of a Blackwater type of a situation under local and state law enforcement in Massachusetts?
You know, my friends at the ACLU of Massachusetts, as you probably know, are filing suit to challenge that very situation. I think that you said it correctly, that the multi-jurisdictional task forces are claiming exemption from public records law on the basis that they're a private company. You know, I wish I had my colleagues from the ACLU of Massachusetts here with me so that they could get into some more details of that situation. They're much more up on it than I am. But that does seem to be the situation. But at the same time, even though they are claiming an exemption as a private company, we also know that they get money from the Department of Homeland Security through Homeland Security's Homeland Security Grant Program, which certainly seems to suggest that at least on some level they think of themselves as a public law enforcement agency. But so we'll see, you know, we'll have to see how that turns out. But the ACLU of Massachusetts could definitely tell you a lot more about that.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll see if we can get Cade Crawford on the show next week.
That'd be great.
She's my lady there. All right. Okay, so now I guess if we could just sort of work through the table of contents here a little bit, and you know, if we could start out with the, well, I don't know, the military training. It's not so much the way that they fight, and, you know, I know they go to Fort Hood or Fort Bliss or whatever, and they do their military training, that kind of thing. But what I'm interested in, if you could tell me about what they're taught, what they are led to believe about the people that they're out enforcing the law against. Because at least the theory, as I learned it in, you know, I don't know, high school or junior college or whatever, or watching Matlock, is the cop's job is to protect the rights of the suspects, right? The guy with the bloody hands is the guy who their job is making sure that nothing bad happens to him before he gets his fair trial, more than anything, right? That's the deal. And then just because he's accused doesn't mean he did it, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, it sounds like we're not even all suspects, which would be bad enough, but we're considered the enemy. We are like the fighting-age males of Fallujah. We may or may not have just planted an IED against these guys, and we're all guilty as hell before proven innocent, it seems like, now.
Well, one of the things that we found when we analyzed 800 incident reports of SWAT deployments was that the vast majority were for the purpose of serving search warrants in people's homes. And to get to your point, you know, I think we need to understand that when there's a search warrant to search a person's home, there, you know, some judge, or not even always a judge, sometimes a magistrate or other public official, has determined that there's probable cause to think that drugs are in the home. That's basically all that's going on there. There have been no charges filed. There certainly have not been any convictions entered. So a service of a search warrant is basically a domestic criminal investigation, but there's been no finding that there's been any wrongdoing. So to use a paramilitary squad to serve a search warrant on a person's home for often a small amount of drugs seems to us as extremely problematic, especially given the often tragic results that can happen. But in terms of the training, we were given some documents by some of the agencies that responded to our request that really did seem to suggest that officers are being trained to think of themselves as warriors. Some of the training documents that we received taught police officers to, quote-unquote, steal your battle mind when you go into the field. And it really does seem like there's an effort to make the police think of themselves as soldiers fighting a war and the people that they're policing as the enemy. You know, we consulted with law enforcement during the course of this investigation because we are ourselves not, you know, we're not police officers. We're not necessarily law enforcement experts. And so we consulted with law enforcement and we spoke to a number of police officers who said that this is absolutely true. It's a cultural problem. Policing has become much more militarized, which really erodes public confidence in law enforcement. So we definitely think that there's an issue here in terms of training, in terms of training police officers specifically to think of themselves as soldiers.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, there's the music's already playing. We're going to have to go out and take this short break, Kara. But I hope you'll stay with us, and we'll do one more segment here on this new report from the ACLU on the militarization of the police. War comes home. We'll be right back in a sec. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Kara Dansky from the ACLU. And this report, terrifying new report that you already knew, but with details. War Comes Home, about the militarization of the police. And to make it a little bit interesting here, Kara, I'm going to try to pick a little bit of a controversy with you. Which is that the ACLU has got to get good on guns. Because, as you know, half the population of America is armed. And in a society where all of our deputy sheriffs and city police are trained to be, you know, the wannabe 82nd Airborne looking for somebody to kill, and anybody even owning a gun increases their point system on the threat matrix up to the level of sending the Waco killers, this is leading to catastrophe all over the place. And of course, you want to talk about race and dishonest application of the law. Forget the pot laws. Look at the gun laws. It's just insane that we have a situation. You know, it's like alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. All of them are legal, and yet we have an entire federal police agency armed to the teeth out there persecuting people for, you know, gun charges, which means they hadn't done anything. They just have a gun that the government says is contraband, which is the just like having drugs that the government says is contraband. Just like someone selling drugs or selling a gun to someone who wants to buy drugs or buy a gun. There's no crime involved other than the government said no. And then it becomes, because a gun is so scary, it becomes then the excuse for, hey, well, the rumor is these people have guns. There was one where the guy had a gun and he had been cited publicly saying the word Constitution before. So that meant he was a political zealot, and that gave him another 3 points on the threat matrix. So they came and with the armored personnel carrier to his family house, right? So anyway, get good on guns, because isn't that a huge part of this? The cops' attitude towards gun ownership by American civilians who, after all, have the right to bear arms.
You know, a couple of points about that. One thing is that when we were reviewing the 800 SWAT deployments that we analyzed, we did not come across, I don't think, a single time when the police distinguished between lawfully owned firearms and unlawfully possessed firearms when determining whether to deploy a SWAT team.
Mm-hmm.
So there didn't appear to me to be any effort on the part of the police to determine whether, if they were going to consider the fact that a person may have had a firearm in their home, whether that firearm was lawfully owned or not. Another thing I would just say is, you know, part of what happens here when they deploy a SWAT team, they often do so in the middle of the night, and they do so using tactics that are absolutely terrifying for the people who are subjected to them. And there have been a number of scenarios in which a person's family is at home sleeping in the middle of the night, as you'd expect. The family owns a firearm, which they're entitled to do in the state where they live. I know one case like this that happened in Texas and one that happened in Utah. And the police did a SWAT raid in the middle of the night, came into the home, and they thought that they were being burglarized. And they used their firearm, and actually police officers have died in this way. You know, police officers have been killed when people believe that they were being burglarized and were acting to defend their home. So I think that this is something that we really need to shine a light on. And getting back to my earlier point, there's been almost no transparency or oversight into the militarization of policing, and I think we need to really be better about that.
Right. Well, and you know, there's got to be some kind of checks and balances, and I'm not really one to just leave it up to, you know, a police hunch to decide necessarily. But then again, outsourcing decision making to something called a matrix, which is like some kind of magical abacus that knows how dangerous people are better. You know, it's like calling a polygraph a lie detector. It puts all this like truth and knowledge and judgment on something that can't possibly have any, right? It's the threat matrix, and the matrix has decided that this is the way we need to do it. It's almost like, you know, zero tolerance in government school where the valedictorian gets expelled over the butter knife or something, because it's just the what the computer screen says overrides any kind of knowledge. Like, hey, are we sure this house doesn't have kids in it or whatever? Is that part of the computer program? You know, how sure are we there are no kids present before we kick in this door? That kind of thing. This is a question a squad leader might wonder, but a computer might not when it's doing its calculation, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the threat matrix is interesting because in theory, it's supposed to bring some objectivity.
Right.
To the decision to use SWAT, which you know, could be a good thing. But the problem is that when they check off the boxes in the threat matrix, it still doesn't give you any insight into why they thought what they thought. So, for example, many of the threat matrices that they use will have a checkbox for drugs, a checkbox for, as you were saying earlier, guns. So if they check, you know, drugs and guns, that weighs in favor often of deploying a SWAT team to serve a search warrant. But it doesn't tell you anything about why they thought that. It doesn't give any substantiation to the officer's belief that there are drugs present or that there are guns present. Those are just two examples. We came across a threat matrix that was in use in a town in North Carolina that used a person's religious views as a factor in deciding whether to deploy a SWAT team. Huh. So, you know, in some sense, having a threat matrix could bring some objectivity, which could be a good thing. But on the other hand, the threat matrices that we've seen don't seem to help the situation because they don't provide any insight into the underlying factors that the police are considering.
Right. Yeah. You know, if you never read it, you'd enjoy this book by Neil Postman called Technopoly. He's the guy that wrote Amusing Ourselves to Death and all that. But he talks about how all this technology changes what we even mean by knowledge and what we mean by decision making, and how so much of it has to do with outsourcing our decision making to, like you're saying, supposedly objective machines, that really it's just a matter of garbage in, garbage out, right? It doesn't say, even if the guy owns guns, is that because he's an 80-year-old hunter and he's from around here and all the cops and all the old cops know him and he's a good old boy? Or is it because we think that maybe he's smuggling Mexican immigrants and is armed to the teeth with him and his crew with AK-47s or something, right? Like, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say, you know, what about what gun or how likely, how criminal the person they suspect is or how desperate they might be or anything like that. That's all the kind of question that can only come up in a soft human brain, not in a computer.
But, yeah, we did not see in the course of our investigation very many incidents where there was that kind of analysis that was being done. We just didn't see it. A few. I mean, there were a few cases where you could tell that somebody was doing some really good work to figure out whether they really needed a SWAT team. Yeah. But the majority of cases, we didn't see that kind of analysis being done.
And again, as you said at the beginning, we're talking about where super majorities of all of these raids are about just contraband, you know, black market trade in contraband and that kind of thing. No actual crimes being committed against anyone else at all. And now, can you tell me how many of these are actual bank robbery with hostages like on TV where they would justify this kind of thing? What percent is that?
We found that of the 800 SWAT deployments we studied, and I should also just back up and say 800 is a tiny sliver of the number of SWAT deployments that happen nationally every year. So this is really an attempt to shine a light on a problem that we think is much broader. But we were not able, you know, by any means. There are tens of thousands of law enforcement agencies. So we really examined a tiny sliver of what's happening across the country. So I just want to make that clear.
Sure.
But of the 800 that we studied, almost 80% were for the purpose of serving a search warrant. About 7% were for the purpose of dealing with some kind of emergency scenario, such as a hostage taking or a barricade or an active shooter. And then the rest were other kinds of situations. Some of them, involved VIP protection, visiting dignitaries, things of that nature. But nearly 80% were for the purpose of serving a search warrant.
And then, I guess because it goes along with the war on drugs, and I'm sorry we're so short on time now, but can you address race and how this is implemented against minority groups that have so much less political power?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've seen over and over again over the last several decades how the war on drugs unfairly impacts people of color, communities of color. We know that people use and sell drugs are roughly the same rates across race, and yet it's been people of color who have really been unfairly impacted by the war on drugs. And the use of paramilitary weapons and tactics appears to be no different. So of the 800 incidents that we studied, we tried to figure out who was being impacted by these SWAT raids. And so we reviewed the reports and we tried to get a sense of who was involved, who was in the home, you know, were there families involved, were there children involved, and we counted up all the people who were impacted by the SWAT raids that we studied, and we found that the majority were people of color. About 54% of the people impacted were people of color. Significantly, when you break that down further into the percentage of cases where the purpose of the SWAT raid was for a drug warrant, 61% of the people impacted were people of color.
All right. We got to go, all out of time. Thank you so much, Kara. Appreciate it.
For having me.
That's Kara Dansky from the ACLU. War Comes Home. Go read it. Send it to your congressman. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And next up is Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy Newspapers, reporting live from Baghdad. Welcome back to the show, Mitchell. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing okay today, but just to correct, I'm in Erbil, Iraq, in northern Iraq, not in Baghdad itself.
All right. Well, you know what? I'm being reminded of the lesson I already learned, that I got to wait till the music quiets down, because for some reason it stomps on your Skype signal when you try to talk. I got some kind of setting wrong on Skype, I guess. So now I'm going to ask you that question all over again, and I think you're already correcting me for getting something wrong, but welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm here in sunny Erbil, Iraq, in northern Kurdistan, where it's hot and relatively stable here, but about 20 miles away, not so much.
Okay, well, start with that, I guess.
Well, what we're looking at is basically, at least as it stands right now, it just really feels like Iraq as a modern state that we, as we know it, has completely collapsed into what I'm calling, you know, the War of the Three Kings. Mm. Essentially, the Sunni, Shia, and the Kurds are all fighting to go their own way. The Shia government of Nouri al-Maliki is desperately trying to cling to power and bring about what I'd call almost half the country that they've lost control over into their grasp again.
Now, one thing was that you had reported, I guess, a couple of days ago that ISIS had seized at least some checkpoints, some positions on a highway to the southeast of Baghdad, attempting to cut them off from Basra. Did that pan out? I think the way you reported it was, you know, somebody said that kind of thing. Was that verified, and does that indicate a real attempt to try to lay siege to Baghdad, do you think?
Well, what we're looking at, they're certainly trying to surround and cut off Baghdad. And one of the things that we've seen from ISIS is that they're a fast-moving group of pretty dedicated and well-trained jihadis mm-hmm. who've been fighting in, besides probably Afghanistan, Chechnya, some other places, have had a lot of experience fighting in Syria. What their method has been in Iraq is they've been working with Sunnis throughout Sunni neighborhoods, Sunni triangle, as we're calling it, in order to sort of rise up and grab the Sunni sections of Iraq itself in a surrounding arc around Baghdad. Mm-hmm. They can't take the Shia areas, so what we've seen them do is cut off the western desert, which is cities like Ramadi and Fallujah. We've seen them come down from Mosul to Tikrit from the north. And earlier this week, I think what we were reporting was that the local tribes to the south of Baghdad had started taking pot shots and sort of doing testing attacks to check the defenses in these mixed neighborhoods. And my assumption is that they're testing the defenses in order to see whether or not they can take those. And if they do take those areas, Baghdad will be more or less completely surrounded and cut off from the government's Shiite population power base in the south.
All right, so now, I guess, could you rank for me the relative strength of the different Shiite armies, the actual so-called Iraqi army, the Badr Brigade, if it is coming back into existence, I guess I read a couple places, the Mahdi army, of course, I guess, and Sadr, hasn't he said, well, he'll protect the shrines, but he doesn't sound like he even wants to fight for Baghdad, although I don't know. What's he going to do, let him take Baghdad?
No, he's not going to let them take Baghdad. Basically, what we saw is about over the course of a week and a half, Iraq's roughly 700,000 to million man army, about half of it disappeared and has been, you know, has been described as combat inoperable, to use a U.S. military term. They dumped their equipment, they dumped their uniforms, and they went home, or they're so completely disorganized that they're not really combat effective. What's been left now are elite units that were fairly well trained by the American Special Forces, who are directly loyal to Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who has pretty much bypassed the defense ministry here and is running things himself. He's starting to act a lot like what you might have expected from Saddam Hussein or Gaddafi, a guy who doesn't trust any of his aides, only a very small number of people close by him. Mm-hmm. And so he's cutting out the normal command and control and operating these special forces, the one's called the Wolf Brigade, the other's called the actually SWAT team, himself. These have been bolstered by what we've seen from the Shia community, where they're reconstituting their militias from the sectarian war that happened while America was occupying. From roughly 2005 to early 2009, Sunni and Shia were fighting each other for control of Baghdad, with America kind of as the referees. These groups include the Mehdi Army. Sadr has said that he will not reactivate his Mahdi army again in a broad sense, but rather they will only fight to protect shrines and their neighborhoods. But the big supporters have been, yes, you're right, the Badr Brigade, which is originally an Iranian-trained outfit that had generally had pretty close ties with the Americans, even when they were here, and Asib al-Haq, which is an Iranian highly trained special group, as we used to call them. They've got very close ties to Hezbollah, and they actually had fought the Americans. They're considered very good fighters. They fought in Syria, you know, after they fought the Americans. And they probably take close to their commands from the Iranian Quds Force. You know, the commander of that is a guy named Haj Qasem Soleimani, who we're told is sort of directing the defense of Baghdad as an Iranian special forces guy. Mm-hmm. So it's a mess, to put it mildly.
Yeah, sounds like it. All right, now, so your latest piece here is all about Kurdistan, and I want to let you cover that in depth, but I want to start it now with the break kind of coming up here anyway, but I'll direct everybody to it. It's Hanging On to Oil-Rich Kirkuk May Prove a Challenge for Iraq's Kurds by Mitchell Prothero at McClatchy News Service. Now, before the break here, let me just ask you real quick to predict the future. It seemed to me like what Zarqawi would do now is he would bomb a bunch of Shiite marketplaces and deliberately try to provoke the Shiites into going, you know, out toward them to fight, rather than getting bogged down in Baghdad and, you know, do some suicide bombings, but not try to really fight for neighborhoods. I mean, that's a lot easier to do when you're the Badr Brigade and you have the Marine Corps helping you, right?
Right. Well, you know, honestly, that's what they've been doing. It wasn't very well reported until about the last month because nobody was paying much attention to Iraq. But ISIS has been doing suicide bombings for months now, if not years. And there definitely was an escalation of them. Every day we've got a bomb going off in a Shia neighborhood. It just seems like right now they're doing probing attacks and trying to figure out exactly what they can hold. They're trying to build a state, whether they say they want Baghdad, but we haven't seen the move on it. Yeah. We've seen the move to isolate it.
But are they trying to provoke? I mean, because you talk about Iraq splitting in three. I mean, it's pretty obvious it's a de facto partition, has been for a while, yeah. And this sort of seems like the final declaration of independence in a way and all that. But I wonder if you think that their strategy is to go ahead and to really pick a fight, to do these suicide bombings, not necessarily to find their frontier, but in order to provoke a reaction and a worse war, which after all would rally more people to their side, although it could ultimately be counterproductive.
Well, that's what they're doing. They're absolutely doing that, is what I'm saying, is yeah. that, yes, they are doing these suicide bombings. They've been aggravating the Shia, who are now doing military parades and going on television, basically threatening to fight the Sunnis, which is further terrifying Sunnis that are on the fence. They think now the Shia are going to come kill them, which we've got some evidence is starting to happen. So, yeah, each side is basically preparing for a continuation of the 2005-2009 war. But instead of for control of Baghdad, it's going to be for control of the entire country.
Yeah. All right. Now, even for, Shiistan, it seems like Maliki's goose is cooked if Sistani is saying that he ought to step down, right? I mean, it's obviously too late for any real compromise with the Sunnis, but
he did not say that he should step down.
No,
this has been a common misconception. What Ayatollah Sistani said was that there should be a national unity government, which, keep in mind, as a prime minister and parliament system here, Iraq doesn't currently have a cabinet, which is what people frequently refer to as the government. They hadn't agreed on that after the elections that Maliki more or less won, who would be in charge of which ministries. He has to bring in people as a coalition, and they had just gotten to start to work on that when this war broke out. Mm. So what Sistani is saying is Maliki needs to start bringing Sunnis into this, that they need to reach out and do broad consensus in order to try to get some of the guys fighting alongside ISIS, which are probably more than ISIS itself, into the government to sort of co-opt them and make the Iraqis feel like they're all part of a government. He did not say Maliki should step aside, but what we are seeing is Maliki is ignoring that strong advice from Sistani. He's ignoring the advice from just about everybody, from John Kerry to the Iranians. Everybody's telling him, you need to reach out to your political enemies and get some of these tribes to put down their guns and become part of the political process. And he's just not hearing any of it so far.
I guess I had thought, and maybe it was just misreported, but I thought it was sort of two things, that he had at first said that he should step aside, and then maybe he had backtracked a little bit, and that was sort of his backpedal was, well, bring more Sunnis in. And then, but anyway, I guess I got that wrong. But anyway, isn't it way too late? I mean, we're talking about the benchmark that never was achieved back in 2007. Now, all of a sudden, he's going to reach out to who among the Sunnis? That's what Patrick Coburn was saying on the show yesterday, was who is there among the Sunnis for him to deal with now that they've let ISIS come to the lead? Because whatever political representation that they had actually in Baghdad left them far behind long ago.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. There is a strong Iraqi-centered tribal and former Ba'athist official tradition and infrastructure in these places. And these guys are currently fighting the government right now. But they are not fighting to establish an Islamic caliphate like their allies, their current allies in ISIS. They're fighting to get under the, you know, to get out from under the yoke of what they see as an oppressive Shiite government. So I do think that there would be tens of thousands of guys that you can co-opt. You can bribe them. You can offer them ministry jobs. The Americans figured this out in 2006 to 2008 at the height of the Sunni insurgency. Suddenly it dawned on them. The guys that were fighting them were fighting for position. They weren't fighting completely to drive America out. And that once the Americans started working with these guys, paying them off with suitcases of cash on the tribal levels and trying to bring them into the fold, we saw the insurgency basically evaporate, and they hunted down the foreign Qaeda fighters that were doing all the suicide bombings, and things got fairly peaceful very quickly. That gain, however, was lost when Maliki didn't bring those guys that had been co-opted into his government. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Americans, to their credit, have been telling him for 4 years. The American government is no fan of Nouri al-Maliki. They've made that clear. He wasn't their puppet that they put in. He won an election, got in there through the political system that the Iraqis had agreed on, And the American advice to him has been consistently, do not screw these Sunni guys over, or they're going to come back. And they have. Yeah. So now I don't know if it's too late. But I do think there are tribal guys. I've talked to them. They're ready to deal, but they're also ready to fight. The question is it too late? And has ISIS become so powerful that people will be too afraid within the Sunni community to confront them? And that, I think, is what Donald Rumsfeld would call a known unknown. We know that's a problem, but we don't know how it's going to get fixed.
Yeah. All right. Now, so to your reporting here in McClatchy newspapers, McClatchyDC.com, hanging on to oil-rich Kirkuk may prove a challenge for Iraq's Kurds. And so I guess when ISIS came in and seized Mosul, the Peshmerga surrounded and locked down Kirkuk. But you're saying that I guess it's been too mixed of a city, and under Saddam's control, it was not in autonomous, protected Kurdistan. It was south of there during the 1990s era, and has been kind of a somewhat slow motion sectarian cleansing by the Kurds of the Arabs since then. But it's basically, I think you're saying here, it's a little bit outside their territory, as it's been up until recently, or at least you'd have to go way back to when it was really a predominantly Kurdish city. So, and then I think this is where you're saying, yeah, the hot stuff is going down 20 miles from here. I think that's what you're talking about, right? Is this new borderland between Kurdistan and the Islamic State.
Right. It's a long, sprawling, you know, sort of front line that there's been activity along it, but nobody's made a big push in either direction. The Kurds did go into Kirkuk. In all fairness, they had been there. Half of Kirkuk is Kurdish. The commanders in that area were Kurdish of the Iraqi army, and even the governor was Kurdish. But it was a place that they'd all been putting off deciding its final status. They were thinking about even holding a vote that just never seemed to happen on whether or not Kirkuk should, you know, be fully administered by the Kurds or whether it should stay in with, you know, under the auspices of Baghdad. But of course, besides the symbolism, it sits on a whole pile of money. It's a very rich oil field area. And so nobody really wanted to resolve the issue too quickly because the losing side was going to freak out. They just kept kicking it down the road. What the Kurds did was change the fact on the ground. When the Iraqi army started to evaporate, they moved in to secure it. And they do get defensive if you say they took Kirkuk. They'd say, no, we'd always been there. We just further stepped into the security void to make sure it didn't fall apart, which is fair, but then you also know they really have no intention of giving it back. Right. The question is, this would be the only area that the Kurds are administering that has a significant Arab and Turkmen population that doesn't trust them. The rest of Kurdistan is stable because it's full of Kurds who like the Peshmerga, who like Barzani and Talabani, and are comfortable with them. They've served them well, even if they're somewhat slightly gangster. So, you know, it'll be a tougher sell to keep Kirkuk steady for the Kurds, but that does seem to be what they think they're going to do. And the other question is, how well do the Peshmerga fight on the flat desert ground around Kirkuk instead of those hills that they've been hiding in for centuries, repelling all invaders? Mm-hmm. So it's a challenge for them. I don't know that they won't be able to do it. I just think it's going to be dicier than people have been led to believe.
Yeah. Their reputation precedes them, but a reputation is still just a reputation. And you quote a couple of experts here, who I'm not exactly sure who they are. I guess you'll clear that up for me, saying, well, you know, I don't know if these guys are really ready to deal with ISIS because they move a lot faster. They have a lot of different tactics. As you mentioned, they're out on flat ground where they're not used to fighting. And really, I think one of them says here that you quote talks about how the Peshmerga really operate in these very small groups of best friends since childhood kind of thing, rather than in any kind of real, you know, division level, disciplined and ordered kind of a way. And that could lead to some real problems if they're up against superior numbers and they can't coordinate in higher numbers themselves.
Well, that's exactly it. They've got a good reputation as fighters. I'd say they're one of the best military organizations in the Middle East that I've seen. I put them comparable to Hezbollah or to Jordanian Special Forces, which are by far the best Arab fighters in the region. But they've also been trained to play to their own strengths, and the situation in Kirkuk does not play to their strengths. So will they be able to adapt? Again, we're going to have to wait and see, but I couldn't see ISIS storming in and taking Sulaymaniyah. Saddam, you couldn't do that with tank divisions, but I could see them rushing up on Kirkuk and kind of overwhelming those defenses, which is sort of what they do, is they use their speed, mobility, and ferocity, and the fact that everybody's just terrified of ISIS, to sort of, you know, come in like we joke from the game from Game of Thrones, they're like the Dothraki or something. They just come riding in at a million miles an hour and scare the hell out of everybody. So now the Kurds might be prepared for that. They are tough guys and they are well trained, but again, Kirkuk does not play to their strengths as a militia. You know, they really do like things a little bit further, you know, up in the hills, closer to their homeland, closer to their own populations. They simply just seem to fight better there. They're untested in a place like Kirkuk. So I do wonder how that's going to go.
Yeah. Now, as far as ISIS themselves and their relative power compared to the rest of the, I guess, basically general Sunni uprising going on here, Coburn yesterday called these guys the Sunni Khmer Rouge, you know, basically just madmen. You quote these guys talking about them that way, too, that they are just madmen. And your friend, the reporter, Rania, that I interviewed yesterday, talked about how Nusra has gotten getting along with the local population down a lot better than these ISIS guys, who really are not much more sophisticated. I don't know. I've seen some things about them fill the potholes and turn the electricity and the water back on in some places, but mostly they seem like they'll crucify you to death. And would you agree that that's actually probably the best thing that Iraq has going for them in the long term, is that these guys are going to burn themselves out and destroy any welcome that they have from the local population quickly?
I don't know how quick it'll be. It's already starting to show. Yeah. The thing is, they're nihilists. They claim to be total protectors of this idealized version of Islam that's virtually unrecognizable to any Muslim I know. And as a result, everybody who doesn't completely adhere to that can be killed. So it really doesn't integrate that well with other populations. And so you're absolutely right. What we've seen in the past, guys like this, we've seen it actually all over. The Taliban were initially welcomed for bringing security and peace in Afghanistan and immediately irritated the living hell out of everybody because they banned kite flying and, you know, all this other stuff, smoking right. And music. You've seen it in Somalia with the Shabab. They were also initially welcomed as, you know, guys that would bring law and order to Mogadishu. And eventually everybody got sick of them and threw them out and pushed them out into the desert. I fully expect the Sunni tribes to turn on ISIS at some point. It's just what sort of bloodbath that's going to lead to is really pretty scary, because you're also going to be looking at a fight then with the Shia. And again, you know, it's just now suddenly you have four balls in the air. Instead of Kurd, Shia, and Sunna, you have Kurd, Shia, Sunna, and school shooters running around in pickup trucks in the middle of all of it. It's just really a recipe for disaster. And that's why the Kurds, they don't know who they're going to fight. They probably won't end up fighting the Ba'athists. They could come to an agreement with those guys, I think. They might very well be planning to fight the Maliki government for control of Kirkuk and their own independence, if the government can ever reform itself and start pushing out. And they're definitely concerned that at some point ISIS is going to want to make a left turn and come into their areas. So, you know, it's a tough one. But I would say, yes, at some point, being such nihilists and being so harsh and inflexible, it's going to be very difficult for ISIS to not wear out its welcome. It's just what that's going to look like is kind of terrifying.
Yeah. All right. Now, Obama announced that he's going to send $500 million now and military aid to back the moderate, very carefully vetted rebels in Syria. And, you know, I take your good word that there are some moderates out there, although it seemed like the Al-Farouk Brigade that wanted elections and to protect minority rights also were cannibals. And then the Northern Storm Brigade that John McCain posed with, they were some FSA moderates. And then, yeah, they told Time magazine on camera that, yeah, we're veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, where we fought against the Americans. And so I don't know how carefully any of these people are being vetted, if that's who John McCain wants to have a sleepover with. But it seemed like even the Obama administration had been saying, kind of as their excuse, because all the pressure has been to do more all this time, that you know, come on, if we give too much weapons to this FSA, these weapons end up in the hands of the other rebels, too. It's kind of a open arms bazaar there in Syria. And how much are we even inadvertently, how many years in a row can you inadvertently, accidentally arm people, I guess might be a question. But do you think it's possible? Are they going to really be able to create some kind of third force? A real FSA that can kick ass, that can marginalize or even destroy the al-Nusra Front and ISIS and Assad, or at least resist Assad? Or is this some kind of pipe dream? Are they really just going to end up handing all these arms to the guys that we're now talking about, or the Khmer Rouge over in Iraq right now?
Well, I mean, right now ISIS doesn't need our weapons. They've already taken all the ones we gave to the Iraqis.
So. Oh, yeah.
I think that gets pretty overrated. If you're talking about, you know, small arms, RPGs, ammunition, things like that, you know, right now the arms embargo is killing groups within the FSA. And you're right, a lot of them are gangsters and kind of criminals, but a lot of them are pretty sincere and just simply do not have the resources, you know, of some of the more radical groups. But, you know, if you give those guys AKs and RPGs, that stuff's really not going to have an effect on anybody else. You know, ISIS and Nusra have those things. So it's not as huge a deal. The biggest question people come down to is they need these manpad systems, anti-aircraft missiles that a single guy can launch, like the Stinger. That is what people have been clamoring for forever. And for the most part, advanced stuff like that is what ISIS and Nusra do not have, but the rebels don't either. That would be a game-changing weapon, but it would also be for the quote good rebels. But it would also be a very dangerous game to start handing those things out so close to Europe. But if you're talking about AKs and RPGs, even some TOW missiles and stuff like that, it's not that big of a deal at this stage. I mean, ISIS could possibly have $100 million in cash and billions of dollars in U.S. equipment, including armored Humvees, MRAPs, Soviet-era tanks that they've already taken from the Iraqis. So at this stage, I don't know whether it's a great idea to try to beef up the FSA and try to reconstitute something, but I don't know if the whole scene can get all that much worse. And the Obama administration's made it completely clear they're not going to really get involved in Syria. I think it's been a notion that we've been arming rebels, or that the U.S. has been arming rebels, which I've studied that pretty exhaustively. There's been a handful of TOW missile launchers that were given to a couple of groups, but other than that, the Americans haven't given weapons, except to a handful of guys. It's been negligible on the ground. We did give radios, some food, some night vision, some body armor, stuff like that, and some other groups did steal that. But in terms of like stuff you can kill with, America's been very careful not to give any of that out to the Syrians, and it's quite possible the reason why ISIS and Nusra are as powerful as they are today is because of all the help that was denied to the quote good guys early on. You know, this is what you balance. But from the Obama administration's perspective, I don't think there's much good stuff that can go on here. And he did kind of get elected on the idea that he was going to get America out of these Middle East entanglements. And, you know, a perspective that you see a lot around here is, well, this is Iran's problem. If ISIS takes over Mexico, America will have to deal with it. But ISIS is next to Iran, and they hate the Iranians as much as they hate the West. I think it's time Iran stepped up and dealt with it. They're part of the reason why America didn't leave any trainers in Iraq. They wanted us out so they could exercise power over the Baghdad government. And, well, if you want to exercise power, you know, you got to clean up messes. Right. So I really don't envy the Obama national security team as they sit there and hash through this stuff. And I really don't understand when I hear Lindsey Graham and John McCain, as much as I know both men, you know, I covered them in the Senate, I think they're smart guys, but I think they're playing a bit of a cynical political game here, because if the administration helps Maliki, then what they're really doing is doing close air support for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard while they fight al-Qaeda. If they don't do anything, you can claim you let al-Qaeda took over. They're going to be able to hit the administration no matter what they do. Right. You empowered Iran. You empowered the terrorists. There are no good choices for Obama. It reminds me of that line from The Wire where the police lieutenant concludes, "You cannot lose if you do not play. It's all, the game is rigged." And from the Obama administration perspective, I think they get it. The game here is rigged.
Yep. All right, now a couple of things on that real quick, and I know I'm keeping you over time here, Mitchell, but I was reading at the Long War Journal that the TOW missiles are ending up in the hands of the al-Nusra Front, and those are the guys who have pledged their loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri, which if the American people, never mind Iran, the American people have an actual enemy in the world, it's the al-Qaeda guys that are the butchers of New York. And so it seems like kind of it is a big deal, even if just symbolically that a single TOW missile would end up in the hands of the al-Nusra Front, and that when George Bush was paying Assad to torture these guys to death for us, now we're backing, in effect, these guys. And when you say, well, show me the weapons and all that, you know, you're reporting from there, and I don't question what you're saying, but it seems like from here it sounds like you're ignoring the fact that Obama and the CIA, and this is the New York Times version too, right, is that the CIA has been coordinating with the Saudis and the Qataris this whole time with the and with the Turks for safe haven, and that the Saudis have spent I don't know how many millions or billions of dollars under Bandar and apparently whoever came after Bandar to the same position. And Obama could stop that with just a stern look. I mean, to me, that doesn't sound like plausible deniability. It sounds like Obama has hired the Saudis to bankroll these guys for us, the same way when Ronald Reagan had the Israelis sell missiles to the Iranians. That wasn't plausible deniability. We saw right through it, and it was the Israelis almost got dropped from the story because of how irrelevant it was that we paid them back for the missiles they sold to Iran for us, if you know what I mean.
Well, there's a couple things here. One, people have a tendency, I think, to overstate American power. Saudi Arabia considers itself in a do-or-die regional power struggle with Iran, and they've got tons of money, and honestly, I don't think they care. The Turks have been yelled at forever to stop letting Nusra and ISIS guys come through, and I don't think they care. They played a cynical game, and unless America is willing to bomb Istanbul or Riyadh, there's a limit to what they can do. But I would say this.
So did Obama try to tell them to stop, though, the Saudis?
How do you know they haven't?
Well, no, I don't know they haven't, but it hadn't seemed like there was a thing there.
Well, it hasn't. See, what I would argue is I haven't seen America particularly involved in this one way or another. But what I would say is that when you look at groups like Ahrar al-Sham and the Nusra Front, Ahrar is the one that actually gets the Saudi money. Nusra gets donations for the most part from the Gulf, and frankly is falling apart. Most of their guys are going over to ISIS. Yeah, they have sworn to Bin Laden, but at this stage, I mean, even from Rania's article, which you guys discussed at length yesterday, at this stage, who really thinks Nusra is that bad compared to ISIS? They're fighting ISIS. They've already said that they will not conduct terrorist attacks outside of Syria. Their only role is to take down the regime. Yes, they have an ideology that we find distasteful and some friendships with people that have been our enemies, you know, in the West, not even as Americans. But the simple fact is, Nusra, everybody gave a very hard time, but they've never materialized as anything more than deeply religious guys committed to taking out the Assad regime. The second thing I'd argue is the TOW missiles, yes, symbolically, that probably isn't that great, although I have yet to see evidence that Nusra has them. I don't doubt it's possible they got a hold of a couple. That's really not that big of a deal. It is symbolic, I'll give you that, but it's just an anti-tank missile. You can buy one that's the Russian equivalent on any black market in the Middle East. It just doesn't have a name that every high school kid knows from, you know, playing a Call of Duty or something like that.
Well, sure, but it goes back to what you were talking about Iran and how this is their problem and all of that. America is, in effect, siding with the American people's actual enemies against a regional strategic rival, right? Iran is not really America's enemy, and Obama even, you know, has said that, yeah, we're doing this to help take Iran down a peg by taking Assad down a peg.
Well, I mean, their goal was to support the Syrians in, you know, in a revolution. Everybody kind of thought it would be quick and easy in the along the lines of the Arab Spring and replace Bashar with a, you know, with a somewhat democratically elected government. You know, everybody was maybe a little naive back in that time. You know, there was a lot of excitement about Tunisia and Egypt, and to a lesser extent, there were more concerns about Libya, but some enthusiasm. But at this stage, what you're really looking at is, all right, how do you go forward? I would say right now, America and Iran can't admit to publicly to their people, but their strategic, you know, interests now overlap. the Americans and the Iranians are not necessarily going to be going at each other in public quite like they have. They're going to have to cooperate unless they want to see an Islamic State in a third of Syria and a quarter of Iraq. And neither side particularly wants that. As far as Bashar getting overthrown, that ship has sailed. I do not think he can regain the territory in the Far East that he's lost. But with the help of Hezbollah, he's already pretty much taken the population centers in the West. I'd expect Aleppo to fall in, you know, completely back into government hands in the next month or so. And essentially, once Mosul fell, the Syrian civil war was over. Nusra is starting to evaporate. Its guys are losing their funding. The new recruits want to go with the cool kids who are, you know, making a lot of noise and getting a lot of play over with ISIS right now. Everybody likes a winner. And I'm starting to see the Nusra fronts having defections, some of their more radical guys, who, you're absolutely right, do subscribe to Al-Qaeda ideology. They're going to go with a winner. They're going to go with the guys with the giant pile of money and ammunition. It's just human nature. So I think in the next 6 months, you're going to see less and less talk about fighting in Syria as the government rolls up the rebellion. They've already taken just about all of the population centers back. Damascus is more or less stable. Homs is destroyed, but in government hands. Hama never quite fell to the rebels and more or less remains in government hands. The coastal area is completely in government hands. And I think you're about to see Aleppo turn into a six-month version of Stalingrad, where the rebels that are inside there that are fighting get completely cut off. Wow. So, you know, and I'm just not sure that at this stage, Bashar, who's fighting for his life, really cares that much about Raqqa or Deir ez-Zor, which probably, if it wasn't for the British, would be part of Iraq anyway. So, you know, what we're seeing is just an end of that story. We're on to a much bigger one, which is right now there's an Islamic caliphate run by, you know, and I agree with Patrick on this, the Khmer Rouge of Islam, that probably has 12 million people and hundreds of millions of dollars. So that's a way bigger concern than a couple of Farouk Brigade guys selling some tow missiles to some guys whose ideology we don't like. This is something that could possibly reshape the Middle East forever. It's going to probably drag Iran into their version of Vietnam because they cannot allow this to stand. And it could very well be that the Saudis might start funding ISIS in some of these tribes in order to really bleed Iran out of revenge for all the times that Iran's gotten a leg up on them. It's really dangerous stuff, but it's all very big picture. And that doesn't even include Turkey, who right now are greatly regretting the fact they let all these Islamists in and it's gotten out of their control. They thought they could play a cool game where they let these guys in, let them go kill Bashar, and then maybe deal with them later. And the thing's gotten completely out of hand for them. And I know firsthand from intelligence officials in the West, they have been complaining to Turkey, you need to know who these guys are. You got to stop letting them come in through the airport. We got kids flying in from Birmingham and Newcastle and, you know, London's south side are coming in to become jihadis, Pakistani kids, you know, British kids of Pakistani descent, guys from all over the Arab world. It was a free-for-all. The Turks just let them come. And they were warned and warned, and now we've seen the result of this, which is there's this huge force running around and also not playing nice with Turkey. They're holding about 50 Turks in a consulate right now in Mosul, threatening to execute those guys if they don't get $100 million. So it's just an epic mess. The guys like the Farouk and Nusra, I hate to say it because, you know, they did fight for a long time, but they're yesterday's news, and they're going to really disappear, I think.
Yeah. All right, now one last thing. I've kept you criminally over time here, and I'm sorry, but I can't let you go with that without asking you, what about the King of Jordan? I saw there's already border disputes going on that line.
Yeah, man. He can't be feeling very good right now. Jordan is what we call a friendly police state. They have a very aggressive and very professional intelligence services that will not necessarily mess with your life so long as you don't try to overthrow the king. If you try to overthrow the king, you're in for a bad week. They are really tough guys, but it's a small country. It's got a small population. There are a lot of people within those Hashemite and Bedouin tribes that are pretty dissatisfied with the leadership, and they do have a little bit of a jihadi problem in certain towns. They've managed to keep a handle on it historically, but yeah, if Iraq falls, this is when you do start to see America going, okay, we can't just leave this to Iran. That would require probably automatic airstrikes. I think America would probably put special forces on the ground alongside the Jordanians in a hot second. Because simply put, you cannot let ISIS come up to the Israeli border, because then you're literally going to be lighting the whole, the whole region on fire. And the Israelis are going to get involved. And if they start getting involved in this stuff, nobody knows how it'll turn out. They're sort of the wild card. They've been quiet. They've done a little bit of attacks here or there to try to ding Hezbollah to keep them from getting high-end weapons. But otherwise, if you notice, the Israelis are staying very quiet on all of this, because simply nobody knows what their involvement might, how it might change the dynamic. It could rally more people to ISIS's side. It could cause, internal fighting, overthrowing of governments. So they're just trying their best to stay out of it for now. But if Jordan starts to look like it'll fall, the Israelis will not be able to continue to stay out of it. They're going to take aggressive actions, and then Lord knows, I don't even know what that'll look like.
All right. Well, thanks very much for your time, and especially for bearing with me and going overtime here on the show today, Mitchell.
Oh, no problem at all. Sorry I couldn't be more cheerful, but I got to tell you, I've been in the region for 12 years, and I keep saying I don't know a lot, because this is so bad, I really have no idea where it's going. In the American occupation and invasion of Iraq, we sort of had a paradigm of what really bad stuff could happen, and that stuff did come true. But in this case, I don't even know what the upper end for disaster is. It's really a mess, and I don't even know who's responsible at this point. It's that complex. There's so many balls moving in the air, so many different people with so many different agendas, and with the Americans and the Iranians, strange bedfellows who I think are really going to have to work together to get a handle on this.
God, it sounds like the only thing that's certain is that they're not going to get a handle on anything, and that everything is just going to get that much worse. I mean, every fact you cite points towards worse disaster, right? Iran cannot stand for this. Well, that just means they're going to rally every Sunni, could be jihadi in the entire region when the Iranians get directly involved in Iraq. I mean,
well, they also might just decide to kill every Sunni in central Iraq. I hate to be cynical about it, but one of the reasons why the car bomb stopped in 2008 was they had, the Iranian backed militias and the Shia militias had basically driven all the Sunnis out of Baghdad.
Right.
If you kill them all, no more car bombs. They did learn that lesson. And I'm afraid they're going to take that lesson to the industrial scale. And you could conceivably be looking at a Rwanda type situation where these guys come in and just decide to clean all those villages out. And, at that stage, then America, what do you do? You want this ISIS defeated, but your allies are literally slaughtering millions of Syrians or civilians in order to get it done. It's a debacle.
Yeah, absolutely crazy. I mean, the headlines this morning are Maliki says, you guys take too long with your F-16s. I'm going to buy some fighter jets from the Russians. So now it's Russia, Iraq, Iran, and Syria against ISIS. And whose side's America on again? I guess everybody's side, a little bit.
Well, yeah, again, it's just, can you imagine? I mean, I'm not a huge fan of the Obama foreign policy in this region, but I would like to express my sympathy to American policymakers. I really don't know what they're supposed to do. We're always really clever and think, well, if I was in charge, I would do this. I wouldn't have invaded Iraq in the first place. That's all well and good. But going forward, I see a whole bunch of terrible options.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it seems to me, I mean, they're saying the armed drones are there today. And it seems to me that the logic is inescapable that they're going to end up invading. I mean, having the Islamic Republic of Iraq from Baghdad to Basra is one thing, but having the Islamic State bin Laden stand between Raqqa and Fallujah like this and all that, no, they cannot let that stand. They're gonna, if it takes it, they'll send the Marine Corps back in there.
Well, I think the Iranians will beat you there. The Iranians will beat you to it, but again, it'll be surreal because America will be bombing by that stage. You're absolutely right. And can you just imagine a year ago if I told you America is going to be providing close air support to the Iranian invasion of Iraq? You would have laughed me out of the room as a crazy person. I would have laughed me out of the room as a crazy person. Yet that's where this seems like it could be headed.
Yeah, no, actually, I would have said, no, that sounds exactly right. America's been fighting for the Supreme Islamic Council and the Badr Brigade and what Iran wanted since March 2003. This whole time, they've been fighting for the Hakim faction first and foremost among all Shiites, and that's exactly what the Army and Marines were doing the whole time, was fighting for Iran. That's why Iran sent Chalabi to tell the neocons all those lies in the first place.
Yep, exactly. Oh, but he might come back, so don't worry. We can talk about that some other time. But Chalabi, he's been cited, and people keep mentioning him as a possible consensus candidate.
No.
The cynical view is, how bad could he be at this stage?
Oh, no. I just can't imagine it could be him. Although I guess I read that his family had paid for the maintenance of a shrine in Najaf for generations or something. So he does have some kind of real street credibility and grassroots power there that probably his patrons in America didn't even know about. So there's a little something there, but that can't be enough to get him the chair just because somebody in D.C. wants it. Not at this point. And I guess if that's what Khamenei wants...
Well, here's the problem, though, is the one thing nobody realized about Chalabi was he wasn't our guy. He wasn't America's guy. He'd been Iran's intelligence asset the entire time.
Right.
And so that's when he finally went on the outs with the Bush administration, was when they realized he'd been turning over classified American intelligence documents to Iran. Right. So, you know, but again, that's for a whole nother show. I got to get going. It's always a pleasure, Scott.
Yeah, thanks very much for staying on, and be safe over there.
No problem. I'll do my best. Take
Talk
it easy,
soon.
Sir.
All right. Bye. That is Mitchell Prothro at McClatchyDC.com reporting from Erbil, Iraq on, the whole damn situation over there. Boy, what a mess. That poor guy was trying to overstate it, and he couldn't come up with a way to overstate what a mess it is over there. Iraq, hanging on to oil-rich Kirkuk may prove a challenge for Iraq's Kurds. That's just one small bit of his great reporting there at McClatchyDC.com. And I guess we're already back from break again. Good. There goes Mitchell Prothro, everybody. And I'm going to have to throw a little bit of an edit on that. Quite a bit of an edit on that. And run that on the KPFK show on Sunday. Man. Assuming the premise of American intervention, I just can't figure support for any rebels in Syria at this point. It doesn't make any sense. Now, that doesn't mean, even assuming intervention, that doesn't mean that they should back Assad and, you know, help train up his death squads to go hunt these guys down and kill them. But I don't know. I'm trying to pretend I'm a Republican or a Democrat, interventionist here, and figure out how to justify intervening for anyone in Syria. And if, thought experiment only, gun to my head, gun to America's head, we absolutely have to back somebody in Syria, it would have to be Assad. The quote-unquote elected. Hell, he's as elected as Hosni Mubarak ever was, or General Sisi. In fact, he's a hell of a lot more elected than General Sisi, America's sock puppet dictator in Egypt right now. And he represents a lot of Sunnis, along with virtually all of the Shia, all the Alawites, all the Chaldean and Assyrian and Maronite Christians, and all of the, I don't even know what, Kurds and... Do they have Yazidis and Turkmen? They must have some Turkmen there. All of the ethnic and religious minorities support the dictatorship there. And it ain't because they love Assad. It ain't because he's a good guy. It's because they prefer him to the al-Nusra kooks and the ISIS, even worse. And, you know, there's a reason that George Bush used Assad to torture and kill al-Qaeda guys. And that is because Bill Clinton handed him the policy. Here's what we do. When we kidnap these dangerous Mujahideen guys around the world that we don't like, or at least, you know, people that we accuse of being bad guys, we give them to Assad to torture for us. Assad or Mubarak. That's what Robert Baer said. He said in the Clinton years, they had a little slogan. It was a figure of speech in the government that if you want them tortured, you send them to Assad in Syria. If you want them to disappear forever, you send them to Egypt, to the tender mercies of Hosni Mubarak. And so that at least made sense, since the Bin Ladenite movement has turned anti-American since about, say, oh, I don't know, 1991 or so. I'm not saying it's moral. I'm just saying from a statecraft point of view, it's, in fact, counterproductive hiring these evil murderers to torture these guys to death. That makes great propaganda for the terrorist groups, especially Al-Qaeda, in the first place. So, but at least it's not backing the jihadists. And I don't know. Prothero doesn't seem to think the FSA is very bad. But a bunch of cannibals and Iraq War veterans. I mean, to me, any Syrian who went to fight with Zarqawi's legions in the last Iraq War and wants to call himself a moderate in Syria now, okay, fine, but that doesn't mean you can have any of my money. And I don't know. I would like to see Obama, I would like to see any indication that Barack Obama had told the Saudis to knock off your support for these groups over there. And I hadn't seen that. This has been a CIA thing, one level or another all along. In fact, as Seymour Hersh reported, part of what got the ambassador killed in Libya was that they had stationed him in the center of a hornet's nest, funneling the hornets and that old secular dictator's weapons to the jihadists in Syria. And that didn't get shut down until September 2012 when the ambassador was killed, Ambassador Stevens, at the conflict in Benghazi, the attack on the video or whatever crap. Then they went, oh man, we got burned so bad, and they finally called it off. And even then it was reported in the Sunday Times, a ship full of guns from Libya and Mujahideen from Libya arrived in Turkey, and the Muslim Brotherhood was there with the al-Nusra guys, and they were fighting over who got the weapons. It's open market. And I don't know, AKs and RPGs aren't that big of a deal. They kind of are, depending on what we're talking about. Although he has a new point that, like, hey, quit arguing with me about 2 weeks ago, because it's a whole new world over there now, man. They have tanks. They have American tanks. They have fleets of Humvees. They have helicopters. They have $500 million they seized from the central bank in Mosul. They've got Blackhawks. They got trucks and tanks and APCs, and they got machine guns, and they got ammo, and they got mortars. That's something that, you know, it was talked about at first because you couldn't ignore it, but they sort of started playing that down a little bit. They tried to, although on Twitter, the jihadists started mocking them and sent a meme around of the First Lady, Michelle Obama, with a sign that says, bring back our Humvees. Oh my God. It's just like Bill Hicks, man. So tired of we arm these little countries and then we go wage war in the name of the weapons we give them. Iraq, they got terrible weapons, incredible weapons. How do you guys know that? Well, we looked at the receipt. But what time's the bank open? 8? We're going in at 9. For God and country, and he's a Hitler, and look, a fetus. Ah, good old Bill Hicks, man. I wonder who that guy would be now. After living through the Clinton years, that would have really been something, you know? And then living through the Bush years, and then now the Obama era, I bet he'd be really great, forged by this fire. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here.
All right, I'm Scott. Wow, the I almost said what I didn't mean to say. The effing right-hand margin at WorldNet Daily is scary. It's a good thing none of it could possibly be true. Especially this one, Michael Maloof. Where do I know that name from, Scott? You're wondering. That sounds familiar. He's got a report here that says Iraq invaders threaten nuke attack on Israel. Oh my God, ISIS has got their hands on some aluminum tubes. Claims Michael Maloof. Why does that name sound familiar? Because he lied you into war with Iraq. Michael Maloof worked with Douglas Feith in what was called the Counterterrorism Policy Evaluation Group, which was those two guys lying you into war with Iraq, focused on ties between Saddam and Osama. And it's a sister project kind of thing under Douglas Feith's jurisdiction at the Pentagon, the Office of Secretary of Defense for Policy, along with the Office of Special Plans, which was run by Abram Chulsky, and had more members and was focused on lying into war based on the fabled weapons of mass destruction. So anyway, Michael Maloof is a liar. And in fact, someone was trying to debunk that Seymour Hersh piece that I mentioned about the rat line and all of the weapons flow from the aftermath of the Libyan war to the Syrian war. And One, I forget who it was attacking Hersh, and they just assumed somehow that Hersh's source was this nut. Michael Maloof? You think Seymour Hersh, the author of The Stovepipe and Selective Intelligence in The New Yorker, that he has Michael Maloof as a source about what's going on in Syria? Really? Well, he told the Mint Press later that, are you kidding me? That is the most ridiculous thing in the world. I didn't waste his time. I didn't want to insult him by asking him such a stupid question in the short amount of time I had him on the show to talk about the story. But how ridiculous is that? That Hersh would write an article, like the rat line, based on the word of Michael Maloof, who Hersh reported lied us into war with Iraq. Give me a break. Although it is interesting to note that he is kook enough. If you look at these neocons, there's a certain lower strata of neocon, apparently including Maloof, but I tend to think mostly of Frank Gaffney, who always pretends that he was the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy or something like that back in the 1980s, but he never was. It was a total lie. Gordon Prather was there. He was the chief scientist of the Army at the time and worked in Washington, D.C., with all the Reaganites, and he said, no, he was never the, whatever, man. He was a big talker. That's what Frank Gaffney was. But no, was never confirmed for any such position. And anyway, some of these guys are such, their role in the neoconservative movement is to push the Islamophobia so bad that they end up actually being good on some things in a perverted sort of a wrong kind of a way. Where Paul Wolfowitz says, embrace the Egyptian elections. They say, well, the Muslim Brotherhood's going to win. And then what are you going to do? Of course, the answer is coup d'etat. But anyway, and they said, don't overthrow Gaddafi, because Gaddafi's right, that it's jihadists in the East are the ones who want his side. And why are we going to help them? And they said this. Some of these neocons have said the same thing about Syria. It's a certain segment of pro-Israel
right-wing nationalism, a very, I would say, like, it seems from Texas, what the hell do I know, but it seems like it's a matter of social strata in the neoconservative movement. And the more uppity neocons like to talk big about believing in democracy and this and that kind of thing, and the lower scum like Gaffney, they just hate all Muslims and all Arabs, and so they actually will contradict the false narrative about America being on the side of democracy and the little guy in the Middle East, which is, of course, the furthest thing from the truth. And they'll actually end up getting some of it right about what's going to happen if little people actually do get the power, because the little people means the only ones who are organized outside of the current state structures are the jihadists. You know, the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood hardly exists at all. Hardly existed at all by 2011. And has been, you know, completely eclipsed and marginalized since then by, I guess, by the FSA, Nusra, and ISIS. I don't even know if such a thing exists at all anymore. But anyway, so it is interesting that here he's, you know, talking about, geez, where Obama's on the side of the jihadists in Syria. Yeah, he is. It's interesting about who can accidentally get a story half right some of the time. But anyway, this whole thing about the ISIS guys have nukes. Give me a break, man. They don't have nukes. And at least so far, they can't get to Israel. But I don't know, man. I think our guest was certainly correct that the Americans would absolutely put troops on the ground to protect Jordan if the Jordanian regime was really at risk of falling and giving these guys access to the West Bank, you know, to the river. And then, man, I know it's a slippery slope argument. We're not there yet, but can you imagine then if it, you know, outright became Israeli troops and helicopters fighting in Jordan? Keep these guys out of the river. and then what that would mean for the rest of the Middle East. Boy, that George Bush. I wonder if he's even watching the news right now at all. I wonder if he's even caring at all, dude. What do you think? I like to see his eyeballs taped open like Clockwork Orange and force him to listen to people who actually understand, explain to him what's happening and why it's all his fault. And I think if there's one thing, you know, oh, and by the way, someone in the chat room mentioned that Prothero, he sounds a little hawkish, a little Republican on some of these issues or something. I'm putting words in the chat room guy's mouth, but that's the way he sounds to me. But I don't care. And the reason why is because he's a reporter. He ain't here representing libertarianism or an essay that he wrote about non-interventionism. He's here representing hard journalism that he's done. And his facts are facts. And any commentary that he has on that, I don't mind disagreeing. I'm not going to bring on a war propagandist, but I will bring on, you know, that's kind of the difference between Lande and Juan Cole. You know, Juan Cole is an opinion guy. And for him to be bad on Libya is just freaking unforgivable. How can he be for a war? Juan, after all this, you're for starting a war? Come on, man. Unforgivable. Screw you, dude, from now on forever. Jerk. Killer. But Lande, he was bad on Libya too. But then I think, you know what? He's a reporter. His opinions are supposed to be stupid. He's not even supposed to really have them that much. He's supposed to just be telling me what the hell's going on in the world. And I guess I kind of like Jonathan more than Cole. At least he was against the Iraq war, unlike Juan Cole. For Juan Cole, that was the other thing about Libya, is it was three strikes and you're out, pal. He had even come out for regime change in Iran in 2009 during the Green Revolution. Give me a break, dude. You're crazy. You can take your crazy pills. Go monger war somewhere else. But reporters, I'm more tolerant of their BS if they happen to think that the U.S. military should exist and do things. Eh. And you know what? I got such a hard line on support for anybody's rebels or anybody's dictators anywhere that nobody's who's not a libertarian abolitionist like me is ever going to be good enough for me on this stuff. So when it comes to reporters, you know, sorry. Most of my interviewees, as you can tell, are liberals. who I just don't argue with them about regulations and welfareism and all that kind of thing, because that's not what they're on about, but usually they're pretty good on war, you know, that kind of thing. But I meant to say, because that was still just a by the way, I like Prothero. He's all right, man. But what I meant to say was, you see what Prothero and Coburn absolutely agree on, is things are about to get a lot worse over there.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy, only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you all. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm here noon to 3 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network. That's LRN.FM. You can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. My website is scotthorton.org. I keep all my interview archives there, more than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And then there's my blog and the whole show archives. I got a bookstore and a sticker store. And I've got a list of embedded, you know, YouTubes of great documentaries to watch and old articles I wrote a long time ago that if you want to go back and see how smart I've always been, you can do that. Yeah, there you go, scotthorton.org. And hey, man, on the right side of the page there are my sponsors. So patronize them, please. Thank you. All right. So I want to do some phone calls. It's Friday, right? So let's do some phone calls. If you guys want to do some calls, the phone number is 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. Obviously, the big topic is the Mesopotamia, as John Stewart always calls it, right? Going on. But there's a lot of other stuff going on in the news, too. If you want to bring up anything else, you want to talk about questions, comments, anything else, go ahead, call in. It's 512-271-4836. And we already got one caller on the line here. And so I'm Scott, and you're on the show. How's it going?
Hey, Scott. Doing fine, thanks. It's Fitz from out in the Bay Area.
Howdy. How are you doing? Oh, I just said that.
Thanks.
Good to have you. Thanks for calling.
Great to be here. Well, I was looking through, you know, like most mornings, looking through antiwar.com, and it was kind of funny, you know, it was one of those, you know, is it onion or is it real moments, because, and I looked back to earlier in the week and to another headline, and basically the, you know, the more recent one was, you know, is to define Congress, and, you know, Congress is actually going to sue him for the right to, you know, to aid ISIS and attack Iraq and invade Iraq again to some extent. And the funniest thing was that I remember earlier in the week they had a point on how Vladimir Putin was actually defying his parliament because they had given an authorization of force agreement that he said he doesn't want to invade Iran.
Right.
Or he wanted, rather, doesn't want to invade Ukraine. And so it's kind of funny how Putin, the evil Putin, is defying his parliament for peace, whereas Obama is defying our Congress for war. So.
Yeah, exactly, man. And of course, I don't know if you saw this thing this morning, or maybe it was from yesterday, by Robert Parrott, Consortium News. About the New York Times, it's New York Times revamps its false Ukraine narrative. I'll be running over the weekend at antiwar.com, I think, probably. And it's about how, Putin has told the parliament that he renounces the war power that they granted him to invade eastern Ukraine. Well, see, he's backing down to all our tough talk and our threat of new sanctions that we were considering putting on him. And it's the Obama administration spinning this to the New York Times that's just regurgitating it, you know, wholesale. Of course, it's all anonymous. And yes, the moral of the story is that cowardly little boy Putin backed down from his horrible aggression that he started over there.
So, yeah, it's hilarious how, you know, but the American rule is, you know, if you give any politician power, they're, of course, never going to give it up. You know, you're never going to be able to take it back. Whereas, you know, in the evil, you know, Russian regime, they're actually, Putin's trying to give it, you know, to you know, relinquish some of his power. But
yeah, well, he's a realist, man. He's a realist, yeah, and he knows that biting off eastern Ukraine is way more harm than good in a lot of ways. And not just because the Americans and the Europeans complaining all day, but just the massive amount of debt and welfare and spending and all, just the financial cost of it, and never mind all the international other disruption, you know?
Yeah, and I was thinking about we might just be the former history major in me, but I was thinking about, you know, how, you know, we learn history so we don't repeat it. But I was looking on today's anti-war, they were saying that how, you know, the Congress is looking to, you know, fighting hard to basically give money or I forgot how many, 100 million, to start up like a, you know, a something like ISIS that's not ISIS. You know, we want like a good, you know, a good group to support like that. Mm-hmm. And just, it seems to me like, didn't Israel try that once when they created Hamas, you know, to rival the PA?
Right. Yeah, it's 500 million. Yeah, it is. It's 500 million. And thanks for calling, Fitz. Good talk to you.
No problem. Thank you.
500 million to back the FSA after, you know, like Prothero was saying, hey, it's another day over there. Of course, as he mentioned, the Nusra leaders are defecting over to ISIS. I mean, the fighters and some of the, you know, smaller leaders. I guess Golani has not yet gone over there and kissed Baghdadi's ring or whatever, but basically he was saying, you know, the Farouk brigades and whatever, their day's over anyway. The whole thing's over anyway. But they're going to go ahead and give 500 million. And, you know, yeah, I mean, you could cite Hamas as a great example. You could look at the Awakening Councils as an example, too. Oh, you're going to go bribe the moderate Sunni Muslims to marginalize the berserker crazies. Well, that makes sense. I mean, again, these Al-Qaeda guys are the scum of the earth. Nobody wants them around. They can help with some hardcore fighting for a little while, but then they gotta go, man. I forgot what the hell I was gonna say. I completely forgot what the hell I was gonna say. I thought maybe if I sat here silently for a second, I would think of it, but it may just be all the way gone. Let's see. The kooks, they're kooks, the millions. Oh, yeah, so the money just goes to the kooks. That's what I was trying to get to. I don't know what the hell I was on a second or third tangent there about, but the money and the weapons are just going to end up in the hands of the ISIS and, at best, the Nusra guys. And, you know, it's funny, but I kind of understand his point of view. I mean, this is where we are, right? Where the reporter guest on the show, Mitchell Prothero, is saying, look, who cares about Nusra at this point? Yeah, so they're sworn to Ayman al-Zawahiri, and basically their goals, their strategy, their tactics are virtually the same as ISIS. They're a little bit more polite. But basically, yeah, there have been Ladenites. But, yeah, they're nothing compared to the true beast that they've created over there in al-Qaeda in Iraq. And remember now, I'll never forget when Zarqawi finally, it was 10 years ago, almost 9.5 years ago, when Zarqawi said, okay, now I'm Al-Qaeda. Colin Powell had said, yeah, this Zarqawi guy is Al-Qaeda. There's one guy with a small group, and he's the link between Saddam and Osama, Colin Powell said in his UN speech in February of 2003. And yet, Zarqawi had told bin Laden, no, I don't want to fight the far enemy, the Americans. I want to fight the King of Jordan. So screw you. And left. And had his own group, Ansar al-Sharia, which was hiding out in, not Ansar al-Sharia, Ansar al-Islam, which was hiding out in northern Iraq, in American-protected, no-fly, no-drive zone Kurdistan before the war. And then after the war, he went missing. You might remember, they said, yeah, this terrorist, Saddam Hussein, gave him a peg leg. That was the lie. That was part of the propaganda about Zarqawi, that these neocons made up to have a story about how Saddam had helped this guy rather than had a warrant out for his arrest. And then it was 2 years into the war, he declared the creation of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's the problem today, 10 years later. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. It's my show. I think on Sunday on the KPFK show, it'll probably be that Prothero interview. I actually have an interview scheduled with Adam Morrow for tomorrow, but I don't think I want to cover Egypt. I think I need to cover Iraq on the KPFK show this week. I don't think I'm going to get a better interview than that one, substantively speaking. And it'll be an edited version because, of course, that interview lasted for 45 minutes and through three breaks there. So it'll only be a partial version, but that'll be on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. on Sunday morning. I think you can probably hear the wife and the dishes in the background at a couple of places. I have to try to fix. These things happen. All right. Anybody wants to call in the show? The number is 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. And So Ukraine has a new deal with the EU. But I don't know if that's really the big headline. I think what's much more important is what Fitz was saying there on the phone. That the Russian president, like no leader I've heard of since Grover Cleveland, has renounced his congressionally granted authority to start a war. I know he's, you know, got a parliament and not a Congress, but anyway, same kind of thing. Who's ever heard of that? A legislature saying, hey, go ahead and go to war if you want, and the president outright renouncing the power. Good stuff, man. So they're talking, and the Russians are talking to Kiev, and Kiev is at least, you know, in somewhat sort of kind of fits and starts kind of negotiations there with the separatists in the east. And I can only imagine, I'm just imagining, but I can only imagine that the Russians told the putsch leaders in Kiev, the pseudo-elected chocolate king government, I guess, if you can call it sort of kind of elected as Assad or Field Marshal Sisi anyway, right? That, listen, the Americans don't really care about you, and they know now they can't have Crimea. And they can never take it from us. And they're not going to really bring you into NATO. And even if they tried, then we wouldn't let them. And so, come on. Shape up and grow up and let's resolve this thing. Nobody's getting anything out of it. The Russians, the only way you could believe the Russians benefited from all this is if you believe the ridiculous lie that they're the ones who started it. Which, of course, is the furthest thing from the truth. And so, anyway, I'm more hopeful about the Ukraine situation than I've been in a little while, I guess. It's been mostly good news. I mean, people are dying over there. Don't get me wrong. They're dying over there. But if the leaders are talking, then that helps. Maybe. And it just makes no sense for anyone to pick a fight here. I mean, for Christ's sake, I guess if you're Robert Kagan's wife, Victoria Nuland, and you think it's a good idea to bring Ukraine into NATO, right? If you're a Hillary Clinton or John McCain, you think that, but who else thinks that? You know what we should do? We should have a permanent war guarantee alliance with the land where Russian civilization was born and put bases right there. And threaten the Russians with nuclear holocaust if they dare to cross that line ever. That's completely ridiculous. Why isn't that completely ridiculous on its face? If you accept the premise that only by threatening the entire world with nuclear holocaust at all times and thereby keeping them all down, do we have anything like the semblance of peace on the planet Earth, then I guess you believe that. And if that's the way you look at the world, maybe there's no way to talk you out of it, but sure doesn't seem like keeping the peace. It seems much more dangerous than peaceful. All right. Again, 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836 if anybody else wants to call in the show. And I had to look at my goddamn notes here because I wrote down some things to remember to talk about. I did talk about the neocons. Oh, you know what? I forgot. Jim Loeb tried to call me back. Doesn't look like he left a voicemail. Oh. Let's see. So, Hicks. I was wondering, why do I have Hicks written here? I know I mentioned Bill Hicks earlier, but he just always comes up, you know? But, what is this about Hicks? I know what it was. It's so important here to talk about. David Hicks' live tweets for Torture Victims Day. The Justice Campaign. At the Justice Campaign. Boy, I better follow them on Twitter right now, I think. I'm going to follow you on Twitter now. Oh, I am already following them. Well, good. Hello, my name is David Hicks. I was in Guantanamo for 5.5 years before being forced to sign a piece of paper so I could go home. 26th of June. Firstly, I want to say thank you for caring enough to join me in a conversation on International Day in Support of Victims of Torture. Oh, that's the hashtag for the International Day for the Support of Victims of Torture. Hashtag 26th June. It's not often that we hear the experiences of people who've actually been in Guantanamo Bay and prison and what we went through. I find it hard to comprehend there are people who I was with in Gitmo who are still there, having to endure the same after 12 years. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about my time in Guantanamo. This is at Storify.com. Just search for David Hicks live tweets or search for the hashtag 26June. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about my time in Guantanamo. I'll start by telling you about the interrogations. From the time I was first taken into U.S. custody, I had a hood placed over my head, goggles over my eyes, earmuffs, and arms were tied. I've now learned that this was to deprive me of my senses so that I would be frightened. It worked. They swore and yelled at me. I had a gun pointed to my head during interrogations. I was threatened with rape and death. They spat on me, kicked, and hit me. They took me to 2 ships before Guantanamo. At one point, I was taken off the ship and they beat me. My hand was fractured. I witnessed some terrible things in Gitmo. People being beaten to the point where they had to hose the blood off the concrete. One guy in the cell next to me had holes in his legs where he was electrocuted. He was too ashamed to tell his lawyer. The worst thing was not knowing. They stole my letters, took out words of love support. I was isolated, didn't see the sun for months. They used to leave chainsaw engines running outside the cells. They rev nonstop for hours. I can't describe what that does to a person. The worst thing was the pills and injections. I've never felt so afraid. I had no control over my mind or my body. I was terrified. And this is a direct reference, as longtime listeners to this show know, of all the anti-malarial drugs, especially, that cause, you know, really bad acid trips among the subjects, oftentimes, and especially in high doses. And this is journalism that Jason Leopold has done groundbreaking work on. That if you're not familiar, just type in Jason Leopold and malaria, or, you know, Gitmo vaccinations, that kind of thing. You'll find it. What's the name of that? I can't remember the name of the drug anymore off the top of my head. You know, it was part of the bails of the Afghan massacre. That was part of his defense, was that he had been shot up with those anti-malarial drugs and that they had half driven him out of his mind, which, you know, he's still responsible, but it's possible that that's part of it. I think they said something about anti-smoking drugs driving somebody crazy, too. What was that? Oh, that was a domestic murder.
Admit it, our public debate has been reduced to reading each other's bumper stickers. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. I made up most of them, and most of those when I was mad as hell about something. So if you hate war, empire, central banking, cops, Republicans, Democrats, gun grabbers, and status of all stripes, go to LibertyStickers.com, and there's a good chance you'll find just what you need for the back of your truck. own a bookstore, sell guns at the show, get the wholesaler's deal. Buy any 100 stickers and they drop down in price to a dollar a piece. You can spread the contempt and make a little money too. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. And, it's the best of its kind, because it's the only one of its kind. Not that many people seem to care, but those of you who do seem to like it pretty good, so that's alright. Storify.com, David Hicks live tweets for Torture Victims Day. It's at the Justice Campaign on Twitter, and then they get into the questions and answers, but I just thought, it's worth reading his introductory tweets about how they completely destroyed him. He says, "I was completely destroyed after 5 years. I can't imagine all the people who've been there this whole time. Shattered." Ah, well, it's not torture when America does it. It's just an enhanced imprisoning technique. Official U.S. committed to training Libyan security force. American Forces Press Service at defense.gov. Official press release from the Pentagon. Washington, June 26, 2014. While Libya's unsteady politics and deteriorating security have complicated efforts, the United States remains committed to training the country's security forces, the Defense Department's Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs told a House panel yesterday. Security and successful development of Libyan armed forces are the biggest factors in Libya's transition, Derek Chollet told the House Foreign Affairs Committee Subcommittee on the Middle East and North Africa. Quote, "Last year, the United States committed to help train a Libyan general-purpose force of 5,000 to 8,000 personnel. This kind of force will help the Libyan government form its core military," he said, adding Libya is paying for the training, which could take up to 8 years. Oh, man. Oh, good. Somebody else called in. 512-271-4836 if you want to, too. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott. It's Chris in Phoenix.
How's it going? Thanks for calling.
It's sunny out here today. I missed a lot of the show. I left to run an errand. But what was the topic when I left? You were talking to a lady from the ACLU, I believe.
Right, about the militarization of police.
You guys were, right. So I just had a quick comment. Like a civil police agency, right, constitutionally in the United States, is effectively a public contract. And it is no more than that. Like the state is a tool. So the state.
Are you. Now hold on a second. Are you referring to the controversy about the SWAT team in Massachusetts that's claiming that somehow it's an incorporated private entity and therefore not subject to the Open Records Act?
Yes.
Yeah. Just to make that
absolutely
clear.
That's not how it works. That's not how a public agency works. We are it. It is only enforceable. It can only do what we say it can do. It is not something apart or beyond, you know, our free will. I mean, it just is what it is, and it goes no further. And anyone
well,
who ever
theory,
tells you anything different about any sort of right, well, I mean, the Constitution is a philosophically very easily defensible thing intentionally. So it's just that easy. That's what a public agency is. And
well,
if someone
you know,
tells
all
you
they are doing
they're
there
wrong
is
their line.
With what they do with these multi-jurisdictional task forces is they're basically just making up ad hoc police agencies to get around any old rules and regulations about how they're supposed to do business. And in this case, this is just a turn of phrase on a piece of paper, really, because they do have to actually incorporate under, you know, some code, right? But they use that word out of context to just try to exempt themselves from having to release any records. That's all that's going on there. It's not really. And I asked her about that because I wondered whether this is any kind of real change. And it sounds like it's more of just a, you know, a bookkeeping trick or a, you know, a loophole to not have to release some records rather than a real move away from say, for example, the jurisdiction of whatever state legislature they're operating under, for example.
So it's the Chewbacca defense,
yeah,
as
exactly.
The writers of South Park would say. The made-up, convoluted argument to try to confuse us,
right.
The constituency and the citizens, like we're dime store hookers.
Yeah, exactly. And to keep us away from the records of what they're doing to us. And, you know, as long as
all
you're
right,
talking about
God.
This whole thing about us and them and popular sovereignty and all that, I mean, I'm an anarchist myself, but I'd settle for the Constitution at this point. It'd be 99% of the way to anarchy from where we are right now, I guess. Mostly speaking, but
and I salute you, sir.
Well, the thing of it is, this is that it's amazing to me. It really is amazing to me how easily they're able to just by semantics change the mission of police into such a military mission. You know, in fact, Chris, listen to this. I have a soundbite here I'd like to play for you. It's from a documentary called Waco: The Rules of Engagement.
Of a couple of agents or a couple of detectives walking up to somebody's front door or knocking on a door in three-piece suits to execute a warrant of any kind is over. And that's where we stand, law enforcement.
Yeah, so there he is. That's how he's just saying, it's just the American people are all a bunch of David Koresh's, and we all know that the only reason he moved to Waco was to one day ambush the ATF or whatever. So all Americans are guilty till proven innocent. We are a militarized threat to their very existence, regardless of who's trespassing on whose property on a Sunday morning or anything like that, and who's bringing deadly force to whom. And he's just saying that's it. If you're thinking of TV where, Hunter, I used to watch Hunter when I was a kid, where Hunter goes and knocks on the door and says, I have a warrant, let me in. He's saying, just forget it. And that was really the beginning of the end, was with Waco. And they really got away with it, where virtually every warrant now is served with a SWAT team. Certainly every felony warrant.
Just remember, if it helps, that the rule is, the founding fathers say, like, you and I are the United States government. And the Constitution is the coin of the realm. And beyond that, people function and create paperwork at their own peril. Anything in conflict with that, anything in conflict with your free will and your law, as long as you're the libertarian credo, law-abiding persons or people, people who don't hurt anyone and your rights, your natural rights can't be violated, right? So anything beyond that, someone acting, it's false witness. You can bear false witness in the name of other things besides God, And, arguably natural law is a manifestation of God, So that's not constitutional. It doesn't make it right just because they,
Sure. Well, and I think the thing of it is, too, like I was talking about with the ACLU lady, is that everybody gets it now. More and more, this is just, I don't know, a household word or whatever, but militarization. I think it's no longer a left-wing or a right-wing or a libertarian kind of fringe political position that we really need some rollback. And thanks for calling, Chris. It's good to talk to you. If anybody else wants to call on the show, it's 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. And, as long as we're on the domestic and militarization type thing, I want to bring up the gun thing again. I'm 100% pro gun ownership, your right to bear arms in every way. I'm against any law really stopping you, other than, I guess I can't really justify you owning thermonuclear weapons, but whatever. I'm against even the existence of the state as a monopoly force, so I'm 1,000% pro-liberty and 1,000% against gun control, so don't anybody misunderstand me. But this whole thing about everybody parading around with their rifles in a sort of screw you, what are you going to do about it kind of a way, that I don't understand. Picking a fight about it in places where it's already legal to carry a rifle, but you don't need to bring a rifle with you into Target, and it's private property anyway. So what point are you really proving, other than, so far this business hasn't changed their rules and politely asked me to leave, at which point I would have to turn around and leave. So what is being demonstrated, other than thickness of skull? And I do think that, you know, the Texas Bill of Rights, for example, says that the state legislature can regulate whether you got to wear your gun concealed or open. Well, I'm against either, you know, regulating it either way. You ought to be able to wear your gun on your holster and walk in wherever you go. It shouldn't be a big deal. But I'm just saying, parading around on private property at Target, at Chick-fil-A, and or whatever, Chipotle, whatever, that seems to just guarantee to cause private property owner blowback by those businesses and their liberal patrons, and I think it's a bad idea. Anyway, see you next week. Thanks for listening, y'all.